The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Anusha Bala, and I work on the Capital Campaign here at Central Library. And tonight, it is my pleasure to introduce Kiran Desai. Before we get started, please take a moment to turn off any cell phones or beepers, anything that makes noise. Thank you. And also, please do join us in the lobby for a book signing after the lecture. Kiran Desai was born in Chandigarh, India, one of four children to acclaimed author Anita Desai and businessman Ashman Desai. The family lived in various parts of India until they moved to England when Desai was just 14. After a year there, they moved to Massachusetts, where she finished her schooling. She then went on to Bennington College, Hollins University, and Columbia University. Desai took 2 years off from her postgraduate work to write her first novel, Hullabaloo and the Guava Orchard, which was published in 1998. This work was recognized by Salman Rushdie, who included an excerpt of the novel in his collection Mirror Work. She also received the Betty Trask Award for this novel. In 2006, her second novel, The Inheritance of Lost, was published to wide acclaim. In the words of Jennifer Berman of the LA Times Book Review, "If Hullabaloo and the Guava Orchard established Desai as an expert storyteller, The Inheritance of Lost distinguishes her as a writer of note." The novel is set in the 1980s in Kalimpong, in the northeast corner of India, where the borders of several Himalayan states meet. It follows the lives of Jemubai Popatlal, a retired Cambridge-educated judge, his cook, and his orphaned 17-year-old granddaughter through times of peace and unrest. These characters' lives are intertwined with the story of the cook's son, Biju, who lives as an illegal alien in New York. Though The Inheritance of Lost focuses on the lives of a few individuals, it is by no means a narrow character study. The novel explores a myriad of contemporary issues, from terrorism to globalization, multiculturalism to economic inequality, and the ever-present struggles for love and acceptance, while remaining consistently intimate and insightful. Last year, Desai won the 2006 Man Booker Prize for her second novel, making her the youngest female ever to win the prestigious award. Earlier this year, she also won the 2006 National Book Critics Circle Award for fiction. Both of these awards came amongst rave reviews from critics and lay readers alike around the globe. It's a pleasure to have her here tonight. Please welcome Kiran Desai to the Free Library.
Thank you so much. It's really such a pleasure to be here. Can you all hear me? Yeah. Oh, good. You know, it's funny. I'm on a sort of endless book tour, and I never know what I'm supposed to do where, and whether I'm supposed to talk, lecture, read for 5 minutes, 20 minutes. You know, I just never know. And I came here, and then they said, well, you know, maybe you should give a talk, give a lecture. And I left half of it in the hotel room. So anyway, I'm sure we'll be fine. I'll just talk a little bit about, I guess, my ideas, the ideas behind The Inheritance of Loss. My first book was so different. I mean, it almost feels embarrassing to say the two titles, you know, in the same sentence, Hullabaloo in the Guava Orchard and The Inheritance of Loss. I mean, aesthetically so different. Both embarrassing titles in their own ways. Both hard to say out loud. I mean, Hullabaloo in the Guava Orchard seems embarrassingly, you know, exotic and silly and unfashionable now. I mean, now that sort of magic realism became unfashionable. Right when I wrote it, actually, it was bad timing. The tide changed that year. And The Inheritance of Loss, which is such a sad title. I mean, I just, I hate to say it out loud. And people always say, what's your book called? What is it called? And the usual, you know, horrible man at the party saying, oh, you're right, what's it called? And you see, The Inheritance of Love is horrible. And it's such a sad title. It means just Paul falls on the whole gathering. And, you know, and there's no conversation after that. Unless, what does it mean? And then, of course, that's all fuzzy. It's a fuzzy discussion anyway. I have to say, though, that when I think about these two books, and while they are very different, there is a link, and the link is very personal. The first book is set in a very small world, a very firm location, a village, orchard in a village, a guava orchard in a village, and a small town, really, and it's a whole entire sweet world. It's a family in a community, and I think I was very much trying to hold on to a childhood version of India, something that I knew I was losing, or that I had lost, or that maybe didn't even exist except for being a sort of version of India that I'd grown up thinking I was part of. And perhaps we all grew up that way. We all grew up as children. Told what it is like to be Indian or to be American in the sweetest way, to be Swedish in the sweetest way. Reading Pippi Longstocking is a wonderful way to grow up and think of yourself as belonging to a certain country and place. And perhaps it's an essential thing to have a happy childhood and to become a stable person. However, it doesn't necessarily prepare one for the world. And that is a lesson I learned quite early on. And when I finished writing Hullabaloo in the Guava Orchard, it felt a little bit like a fake construct, and as if it didn't give me the intelligence I needed to deal with the life I was living. And when I was about 13 or 14, we left the sort of life I'd always lived in a very secure community, in a sort of westernized, middle class, upper middle class family in Delhi. Very secure, no chink really, no feeling of doubt seeping in. And we left for a town in the Himalayas called Kalimpong. My mother, being a writer, that decided that she couldn't write well in the city, and she wanted to go up and work. And of course, it was romantic and beautiful and a perfect place to be a writer, in mist coming down, rain pouring down, verandas where you could read very intensely. You could read Dostoevsky and Crime and Punishment. And, it was perfect for that. It really was. And you could see the connection between Russian literature and Indian literature, all sorts of connections. And really, with sort of books everywhere, there were all these old libraries up in the mountains left behind by the British. Really wonderful. A lot of them having sort of disappeared now for one reason or another. But it was a happy writing life, it was very disconcerting in other ways. It was a time when political trouble was just beginning on the hillside. A movement called, led by the GNL of Gurkha National Liberation Front, demand by Indian Nepalis for political power and economic power. And it was a messy part of the map, of the Indian map, and the borders had shifted, had been shifting for as long as anyone can remember. It's between Bhutan, Sikkim. It's a part of the country that's in a little knob to the right, a little knob sticking out of the shoulder of India, between Bhutan, Sikkim, and China, to Tibet, really, to the north. And there'd always sort of been fights, arguments, one town stolen by one party, another one stolen by another one, movements of people in that landscape. Everyone on that hillside remembered when the Chinese cracked down on Tibet, and older people on the hillside said, it was 1959, I think, so they just saw Rows of monks, just lines of monks pouring down into India. It just looked as if the hills were on fire. You could just see these orange robes coming down. And so there was that instability as well. And the Indian army had always been a huge presence. When Indira Gandhi was prime minister, she sort of maneuvered a plebiscite where people voted in Sikkim as to whether they wanted to remain an independent kingdom or whether they wanted to be part of India. And they voted for all kinds of reasons, but partly because Sikkim had a large Nepali population to be part of India. So India sort of really swallowed Sikkim. Bit of history that's not really spoken about. And I think growing up at age 13 or 14, I became so aware of all these novelistic moments, really, of realizing that there were so many stories in this little patch of land. And what I thought of as my home, my house, my story, was really not. There were many stories laying claim to that same little patch of hillside, and other stories, you know, had greater claim, perhaps had greater claim. And, of course, it was unsettling. We left. The house was eventually sold, although my aunt still lives up in the hills in an old house, old British house, where she first bought it as a young woman. She was docked up on the hillside, pushed open the door into what she thought was a ruin, and found this beautiful old house, but overgrown with creepers and ferns, and an old English woman in the big brass bed being eaten alive by maggots, blind, old, being abandoned by servants. So there was also that feeling in the back of a place like Kalimpong, for another empire, another lot of people very secure in their position, having been completely wrong, just like this little community that I belong to. We were not really all that secure. And we left and went to England and then to the United States. And I was writing this book, one of the really interesting things was I hadn't expected to go back to India. And I was led back because there were so many parallels in the debate. I couldn't really complete my experience without thinking about what had happened there at that time, seeing this immense parallels of that whole immigrant debate, and what does it mean to be an immigrant in this country? What does it mean to be an immigrant in India? We always think of it as a Western issue, but of course, immigration, exile, refugees, people coming flooding into your country as refugees, that's a debate that exists in every country. You just think, what does it mean to be cheap labor in the States? What does it mean to be cheap labor in India? To have been brought by the British to work on the tea plantations in India several generations on, shouldn't you have some political power? Shouldn't you have some economic power? Should your language be taught in schools? I mean, all these huge debates that are so difficult to talk about, especially when you're talking about a landscape that's always been moving and a history that's never really pure, that hasn't been pure, that you always realize there are many stories, many people who are right about it all. And I wanted very much to talk about that and the immigrant community, therefore, in this country, people who are coming in into the United States, coming into the Western world with this broken, odd background of not having a simple vocabulary or a simple heart or simple intelligence, of having already wondering where home really lies, or if it can be a pure notion, and then wondering if you can enter into a simple vocabulary of loyalty to a flag. I mean, this is, you wonder about why there's so many problems in the immigrant communities, and everyone's so worried right now, and especially at this time. And I was thinking very much about it, of course, as an immigrant. And what does it mean to be part of that shadow class, that class that's always moved, that's always been cheap labor? Because, of course, the same people are poor in India as are poor in this country. It's the same families. And the big question, what does it mean to have no papers and be really, really belong nowhere? to have no, to be completely illegal and be worried about getting your green card. I mean, the green card problem, which is so enormous. I think I spent years of my life worrying about it and thinking about it. And I always think there should be a special word in the dictionary to, you know, that refers to green card anxiety. And in a city like New York, it just hangs over every street corner. It's one of the most common discussions in the city, I'm sure. So I'm going to read a passage that's set in one of these sort of underworld communities. It's sort of shadow class communities. It's set in a restaurant called the Queen of Tarts. And it features Saeed from Zanzibar and Biju from India. Because, again, one of the interesting things about these communities is that they are bringing together, you know, the developing world is really meeting for the first time in the basement kitchens of the Western world. And I wanted to talk about the parallel experiences. And it also features Biju's father, who's a cook in Kalimpong, and he's writing letters to his son. So here we go. Queen of Tarts. Saeed caught a mouse at the Queen of Tarts, kicked it up with his shoe, dribbled it, tried to exchange it with Biju, who ran away, tossed it up, and as it came down, kicked it squeaking up again, laughing. So it is you who has been eating the bread, and it is you eating the sugar. It went hysterically up until it came down dead. Fun over, back to work. In Kalimpong, the cook was writing on an airmail form. He wrote in Hindi and then copied out the address in awkward English letters. He was being besieged by requests for help. The more they asked, the more they came, the more they asked. Lam Sang, Mr. Lubsang Fansok, Kay Sang, the hospital cleaner, the lab technician responsible for the tapeworm in formaldehyde, the man who plugged the holes in rusting pots, everyone with sons in the queue ready to be sent to America. They brought him little packets of nuts or raisins as gifts, offered him a drink at the ex-army Thapa's canteen, and he was beginning to feel as if he were a politician, a bestower of favors, a receiver of thanks. The more pampered you are, the more pampered you will be, the more presents you receive, the more presents you will get, the more presents you receive, the more you are admired, the more you will be admired, the more you are admired, the more presents you will get, the more pampered you will be. Look, you have to have some luck, the cook would begin to lecture them. It is almost impossible to get a visa. It was superhumanly difficult, but he would write to his son, let's see, perhaps you will get lucky. Biju, he wrote, you have been fortunate enough to get there. Please do something for the others. Then he applied a homemade mucilage of flour and water to glue down the sides of the airmail forms, sent them finning their way over the Atlantic, a whole shoal of letters. They would never know how many of them went astray in all the rickety connections made along the way, between the temperamental postman in the pouring rain, the temperamental van across the landslides on the way to Siliguri, the lightning and thunder, the befogged airport, the journey from Calcutta all the way to the post office on 125th Street in Harlem that was barricaded like an Israeli army outpost in Gaza. The mailman abandoned the letters atop the boxes of legal residence, and sometimes the letters fell, were trampled, and tracked back outdoors. But enough came through that Biju felt he might drown. Very bright boy, family very poor, please look after him. He already has a visa, will be arriving. Please find a job for Porish. In fact, even his brother is ready to go. Help them. Sanjeev Tom, Karma Ponchu, remember Budhu, watchman at Monami, his son. I know, man, I know how you feel, Saeed said. Saeed's mother was dispensing his phone number and address freely to half of Stone Town. They arrived at the airport with $1 in their pocket and his phone number, seeking admittance to an apartment that was bursting with men already, every scrap rented out. Rashid, Ahmed, Jafar Abdullah, Hassan, Musa, Lutfi Ali, and a whole lot of others sharing beds and shifts. More tribes, said Saeed, more tribes. I wake up, go to the window, and there, more tribes. Every time I look, another tribe. Everybody's saying, oh, no visas anymore. They are getting very strict. It is so hard. And in the meantime, everybody who apply, everybody is getting a visa. Why they do this to me, that American embassy in Dar es Salaam? Why? Nobody would give that Dooley a visa. Nobody. One look and you would say, okay, something wrong over here. But they give it to him. Sayyid cooked cowpeas and kingfish from the price chopper to cheer himself up, and plantains and sugar and coconut milk. This goo mixture smelling of hope so ripe, he slathered on French bread and offered to the others. The sweetest fruit in all of Stonetown grew in the graveyard. And the finest bananas grew from the grandfather's grave of that same wayward Dooley whom the American embassy in Dar es Salaam had so severely misjudged as to give him a visa. So Sayyid was telling them when he glanced out of the window, and in a second he was under the counter. Oh my God, whispering, it's the tribesman, it's the tribes. Please God, tell him I don't work here. How they get this address? My mother! I told her no more. Omar, he also works in the Queen of Tarts. Go, go, tell them to leave. Outside the bakery stood a group of men looking weary as if they'd been traveling several lifetimes, scratching their heads and staring at the Queen of Tarts. Why do you help? Asked Omar. I stopped helping and now they all know I won't help and nobody comes to me. This is not the time to give a lecture. Omar went out. Who? Soyad? Sayyid? Sayyad? No one of that name. Just me and Biju. But he work here, his mother tell us. No, you all get moving. Nobody here who you want to see. And if you make trouble, we get into trouble. So I ask you nicely, go. Very good, said Sayyid. Thank you. They have gone? No. What are they doing? They're still standing and looking, said Biju, feeling brave and excited by someone else's misfortune. He was almost hopping. The men were shaking their heads, unwilling to believe what they'd heard. Biju went out and came back in. They say they will try your home address now. He felt a measure of pride in delivering this vital news, realized he missed playing the sort of role that was common in India. One's involvement in other people's lives gave one numerous small opportunities for importance. They will come back, said Sayyid. I know them. They will try many more times, or one will stay and the others will go. Close the door, close the window. We can't close the shop. Too hot. Can't close the window. Close it. No. What if Mr. Bosher visit us? He was the owner who dropped by at odd moments, hoping to surprise them doing something against the rules. No sweaty bossy, Sayyid would tell him. We do everything you tell us, just like you tell us. But now, it's my life we're talking about, man, not little hot here, little hot there, boss or no boss. They closed the window and the door, and from the floor he telephoned his apartment. Hey, Emma, don't answer the phone, man. The Dooley and all them boys have come from the airport. Lock up, stay down, don't stand, don't go near the window. Ha! Why they give them visa? How they get the ticket? They could hear the voice at the other end. Then it vanished into Swahili in a potent dung form, a rich steaming animal evacuation. The phone rang in the bakery. Don't answer, he said to Biju, who was reaching for it. When the answering machine came on, it went off. The tribes, said Sayyid, they're always scared of the answering machine. It rang again and then again. Tring, 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 tring. Answering machine, phone down. Again. Tring, tring. Sayyid, you have to talk to them. Biju's heart was suddenly pulsing with the anguish of the ringing. It could be the boss. It could be India on the line. His father. Dead, dying, diseased. Omar picked it up and a voice projected into the room, raw and insistent with panic. Emergency, emergency, we are coming from airport. Emergency, emergency, Sayyid, Sayyid. He put it down and unplugged it. Said, those boys, let them in. They will never leave. They are desperate, desperate. Once you let them in, once you hear their story, you can't say no. You know their auntie, you know their cousin. You have to help the whole family. And once they begin, they will take everything. You can't say this is my food, like Americans, and only I will eat it. Ask Thea, this is his girlfriend. She was the latest pookie interest in the bakery, where she lived with three friends. Everyone goes shopping separately. Separately, they cook their dinner. Together, they eat their separate food. The fridge they divide up and into their own place, they put what is left in a separate box. One of the roommates, she put her name on the box so it say who it belonged to. His finger went up in uncharacteristic sternness. In Zanzibar, what one person have, he have to share with everyone. That is good. That is the right way. But then everyone have nothing, man. That is why I leave Zanzibar. Silence. Biju's sympathy for Saeed leaked into sympathy for himself, then Saeed's shame into his own shame. That he would never help all those people praying for his help, waiting daily, hourly for his response. He too had arrived at the airport with a few dollar bills bought on the Kathmandu black market in his pocket, and an address for his father's friend Nandu, who lived with 22 taxi drivers in Queens. Nandu had also not answered the phone and had tried to hide when Biju arrived on his doorstep. And then when he thought Biju had left, had opened the door and to his distress found Biju still standing there 2 hours later. No jobs here anymore, Nandu said. If I were a young man, I would go back to India. More opportunities there now. Too late for me to make a change. But you should listen to what I'm saying. Everyone says you have to stay. This is where you'll make a good life, but much better for you to go back. Nandu met someone at his work who told him of the basement in Harlem, and ever since he had deposited Biju there, Biju had never seen him again. He had been abandoned among foreigners. Jacinto, the superintendent, the homeless man, a stiff bow-legged coke runner who walked as if his balls were too big for normal walking, with a stiff yellow bow-legged dog who also walked as if his balls were too big for normal walking. In the summer, families moved out of cramped quarters and sat on the sidewalk with boom boxes. Women of great weight and heft appeared in shorts with shaven legs stippled with tiny black dots. And groups of deflated men sat at cards on boards balanced atop garbage cans, swigged their beer from bottles held in brown paper bags. They nodded kindly at him. Sometimes they even offered him a beer. But Biju did not know what to say to them. Even his tiny brief, hello, came out wrong, too softly so they did not hear, or just as they had turned away. Thank you so much. Thanks.
I think I was exactly on time, right? 25, 30 minutes? I'm impressed.
No, I thought that was a great reading and everybody seemed to enjoy it. That was very animated. It was terrific.
Thank you. Thanks.
The way we handle the Q&A, put your hand up, I'll call on you. Leave your hand up, please, so we can get you a mic and we'll try to get to as many questions as possible. First question. Right here.
Are you going to have this made into a movie? And would you consider having Night Shyamalan, who is from Philadelphia, make that movie?
Would I consider having Night Shyamalan direct it? I've never seen a Night Shyamalan movie. I don't know how. I keep seeing the advertising for, I mean, he's doing advertising for Visa cards, isn't it? But
we won't tell him.
But that's about... I don't know how I've managed to escape to her. I don't know. But, you know, I have to say that I rarely watch movies. I'm completely uneducated in that field and I have no memory once I watch one. With books, it's particular. I remember exactly what I read, what happened. And with films, it just vanishes. I don't know why it is, but and people get very angry with me because I can't follow plots. I just don't have that intelligence. Everybody else knows, oh, that's the double, that's the same person in a different outfit. I can't put it together, and my mind wanders, and it's really terrible. But I've had no interest at all. Maybe filmmakers, you know, unconsciously realize this, but I haven't had any any sort of people coming up and saying they'd like to make a film. I mean, I wouldn't mind, but no, nobody's asked.
Another question. You're on the aisle.
You've probably been asked this question before. I wonder how your mother's writing or the fact that your mother's a writer may have influenced you. And also, I think your mother wrote a book called Baumgartner's Bombay, which was about an immigrant in Bombay.
Yes.
So I wonder if that was any kind of an influence on you.
You know, she's been such a huge influence. And sometimes regarding her books, it's often a critic or a journalist will point it out and say, oh, your book reminds me so much of whatever book of your mother's. And then as soon as they say it, I realize it and say, yes, it's true. And it's hard for me to even realize where it, you know, understand where it came from, because, of course, I grew up reading her books. But also we have the same family history. We lived in the same houses, in the same places. Baumgartner's Bombay is certainly a book about feeling very foreign wherever you are. Something I think my mother knew, you know, it was very close to her because her own mother was German, living in India, and she always says that for that reason she always felt as if she had was a little bit outside, always felt a little bit of an outsider. And of course, you know, once you feel a little bit of an outsider, it seems endlessly possible to journey and travel. And both of us left India together, went to England and then to the States and also to Kalimpong. So our experiences are so close. And another book a lot of people point to is Fire on the Mountain, which has an old woman who's just determined to live a solitary life. And and a little child who comes up, I think it's her granddaughter who comes to stay with her and their relationship. And that's so close, you know, to the judge in my book and his granddaughter. So yes, a huge influence, but in terms of actually of the writing life, you know, I think the first book, it was wonderful to have her. The second book, I needed her much more. It was a much more difficult book to write, and it was disconcerting because, of course, I was growing older and I thought I'd be much more, the second book would be easier and I would be much more an independent writer. And I found that I relied on her a lot more. She's somehow the only one who understood what I was writing about. But also I sort of done with writing workshops where I was writing in a very self-conscious way. My first book, I think, was out of that process of just really writing very self-consciously and quickly for a group. And when I was finished with it, I retreated to a much more old-fashioned way of writing, which was her way. And I realized that something much older was coming back, and I was working out of a much older rhythm, something that I'd grown up with, of someone writing in a country that was still cut off. I mean, India in those years was, you know, really had a closed-door economic policy. It felt very far away. And the publishing world was far away, and the publishing world within India was very small. So I felt as if I was writing this book according to her rhythm of working, very much like a hermit, very quietly and slowly.
Another question. In back here on the aisle.
Thank you for the book, because it was really like food for my soul.
Thank you.
Spending summers at Monjula in Kalimpong.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I recognize the name of the house.
Yeah, Monjula actually burnt down. The GNLF burnt it down.
Yes.
So it was just sad, but I was curious about you focusing on the loss associated with immigration, and wondered if you could talk
about
that.
I mean, I think partly that is one of the problems. The title is that it really concentrates on the loss, and I think directs people to the sadder side of the book. I mean, it's the only title I could find that seemed to fit, but it doesn't reflect. And the other thing that I was trying to do, which was to bring about, you know, try to write about the humor of the immigrant experience and the richness of it, because I don't think you undo it once you've gone through it. And people always ask, well, would it be much better to, you know, retreated, stayed in a small world, a secure location? No, you never want to once you've experienced that richness, no matter how hard it is or how at sea you feel or how you feel the world, you know, the firmness of the ground is disappearing from under your feet. Yet, there's so much to it, and I would never have been able to write this book without leaving India and living in a city like New York, where the door was open to so many different parts of the world. You know, I would never have met anyone from Zanzibar and seen that parallel. So a lot of it was an attempt to try and bring that in, but you're right. I mean, on the whole, it's the saddest side of it all, and I suppose it's because it does concentrate on characters. I mean, I do write about characters who are more at the losing side of the big power games, you know, who are sort of, I do feel, being betrayed.
Next question, right here in front.
I loved The Inheritance of Loss, and I thank you for writing it.
Thank you so much.
I would like to know what you are working on, if you have time, with this book tour. Is there a new book in your future that you are working on now? I can't wait to read it.
I mean, I wouldn't be having, well, just insomnia. I find that I never know in advance what I'm going to write, and it's always a process of sitting at my desk, and one thought leads to another, and one character leads to another, and I wish I was a different sort of writer, but I never know the story when I begin, as I'm working in the dark for years. And I've had no time at all. I'm so slow, and I write in such a, you know, I've always given myself that luxury of time, and I've paid for it in other ways, and I grew steadily poorer and poorer, but that way of being able to linger and work and, you know, not do anything for days and weeks. And I know it's writer's block, and yet I always experience it as a, I don't experience it as a pain. I mean, you know, I sit there, look out of the window, I don't write, I read a little bit of poetry, I read something I wrote before, I write a line, the sun comes in, move your feet into the sun, hours go by, months go by, years went by, 7-8 years went by. And I love that life. So I feel as if, I mean, I can't wait to get back to writing, but right now it's usually travel half the day and then a reading in the evening, and then I wake up at dawn and travel to another city and then read in the evening. So that's, I've been it. I'm sure it'll end, it'll be changed by the summer, but right now.
All the way in back.
Do you consider it unfair to call your book an immigrant book rather than a post-colonial?
Sorry, can you repeat that a little bit?
Do you think it's unfair to characterize your book as an immigrant, quote-unquote, experience rather than a post-colonial?
I don't know which category I would put it into, because I thought it would be completely an immigrant book, in that I thought I would write entirely about my own experience in the States. But found I couldn't complete the argument without going back in the past, because I was, you know, just realizing that what I was experiencing was sort of the result of many generations having gone between East and West and traveled, and my own journey wasn't a new journey, but it was a very old journey that my parents had made, my grandparents had made, and I could have drawn the lines even further back. So it took me to the past, but it also took me back to India, because I think, as any immigrant knows, half the story is continuing on the other side of the world. And you're always leaving half the narrative behind, half your family's often left behind. There's always someone left behind, someone very close to you. And yet you don't know what they're going through on a day-to-day basis. So it just became a funny sort of book. I mean, I don't know whether you would call it an immigrant book or a post-colonial book. I'm always terrified of calling it a post-colonial book because, you know, once you enter into that debate, you had better have read a lot, because there you sent off to every single university and college, and you had better have read your Edward Said and your, you know, all your different commentary on the whole entire subject. There's such a vocabulary to that term. And I have to say for myself, I must have been extremely lazy, because I have never sort of followed it. I've always just insisted on writing without being self-conscious about that vocabulary.
Over here on the left.
Thank you. Mr. Desai, thank you for a magnificent novel. I read it cover to cover in one fell swoop.
Really?
Yes. And I love the conclusion when your character Bijou loses everything that he has assembled. And
he's kidding about that.
Just a joke.
And, you know, love is the triumphant moment. Even his masculine gender falls away. He's wearing a lady's frock. It's quite nice. And I wondered, as I was reading along, about Bijou when he falls and hurts his knee in the restaurant somewhere. And I braced myself. I thought maybe we would now enter the world of medical attention for the underclass. But you had him heal himself, which I thought was rather signal. And another tiny question.
I haven't seen it that way.
Reading along, I wondered if, for those of us who have no sense of the dialect expressions, maybe a little glossary of what was being said, you know, these chants and incantations and protestations that were uttered from time to time by many characters. And you get a sort of music, but it would be fun to know if there was something more
exactly
specific.
Well, thank you for saying that, because you did say something that I hadn't seen that Bijou's life entirely in that way, but it is in a way tragic. I didn't want to enter into that whole into that whole medical debate, which is a big one, but for me he's a very dignified character in every way, really, someone who's managed to preserve himself despite being on the wrong side of the sort of economic game. But regarding the question about the foreign words, you know, it's such a difficult one. It's so hard, because as an Indian author, you're automatically working in an imperfect language. You know that the language, your language can never perfectly capture what is happening. And it's a huge debate in India as to whether an Indian writer writing in English is even able to capture what's happening in India. There's a lot of anger against the language and people who write in it, and a feeling that people write for a westernized audience and, not really being true to the story, therefore sort of explaining things and working not as a writer, but working as a translators, really, rather than authors. I would make the argument that it doesn't matter what language you're writing in India. You're always going to be writing in an imperfect language, because it's a country of so many languages and so many dialects. You can't capture the way everybody talks, and have people understand. I mean, have it all hold together. I mean, you'd be writing lines in so many different dialects and languages. You know, I think a writer like Rushdie is perhaps the first one to really stand up and just write in write in his language, which is not a language common to all Indians, but it was his Bombay Indian English mixture of different languages and just put out. Then it's not always easy for people outside that to understand. You know, if you're an Indian from the south, you wouldn't understand it very well. So it's so hard. And when I go back to India, go back to Delhi, where my family is from, and I hear people talk, their sentences are completely half and half. It's completely half English, half Hindi. Two words in English, three words in Hindi, two words in English. There's no way you can, it's very hard to capture that as a writer. And working with publishers in the States, of course, they don't want you to use that language. They want every word to be translated into English. And what I tried to do was to show the context and to indicate what the words meant. While yet keeping some of the rhythm, because some of the jokes, some of those words just don't translate, and it's very hard to give them up. And in a way, yet if you explain too much, I think if you really go ahead and explain, you are putting your putting any reader at a distance. Again, it becomes a sort of anthropological study. It doesn't become, you know, if once you say dal is this, and first you put the lentils in the water and you cook them, when you're explaining how to cook it, then you know your integrity is gone as a writer. So it's very hard. And when I read, you know, I'm reading Mishima now, and there's so many things I don't understand at all, and yet I know. So I'm an imperfect reader. I think perhaps a glossary is perhaps the best solution, and some of my publishers have done that. Yeah, you may be right that might be the best answer.
Take another couple of questions, about five back on the aisle here.
Hi, I'm an engineering student, and I'm quite possibly one of the youngest one here, but the reason I'm here is that I've had a very similar life like yours so far. I left India when I was 15. I'm 19 now. And I have found myself writing only after I moved. And
you thought of yourself as?
As completely an engineer. Everyone's been an engineer for generations in my family. And so I was just wondering if it's, should I consider myself a writer, or is it just me being human?
Are you...
I do write a lot.
You know, this is why you should talk. You should answer back to Naipaul, because I mean, when you talk about whether fiction is dead or not, writing is human. It goes well beyond it. Whether books are being sold or not is even beyond the, you know, the real question. It doesn't matter. People do write.
I seem to be only able to write nonfiction, which is why I seem to write that well. Which is why people call me a weird engineer, because I write and I'm an engineer, which apparently engineers aren't supposed to do.
I think if you write, you're a writer.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
So you must be.
Third row right here.
Just a comment on that gentleman's question where he asked about you writing about India and glossary. I wanted to mention there's a part where Biju goes to serve an apartment with three women, and he supplies their food, and you wrote something about that they could live in the East and the West, and then the red set and the white set, and I think that's the state where a lot of Indians are, so it's not really possible to sort of talk about it in a way that a lot of Western people would understand. So that gap would always be there when we are writing Indian stories in English, I guess.
I think there is that gap. I'm always so conscious of it. I mean, especially since I live between places and I'm writing, it can't help but be very conscious of that gap. What really always worries me is that, you know, there's still a common language for us, even if they're sentences we don't understand. But, you know, there's so many gaps on the shelf And I wonder, I mean, there's a certain kind of Indian book that's being published, and a certain kind of writer, a certain kind of, you know, something that manages to carry across. And of course, again, something in India that people talk about a lot is that a lot of it can't carry across and is not being carried across. There's a particular kind of Indian authors grown up reading books from the States. And I grew up reading Little House on the Prairie and Huckleberry Finn and Jane Austen. There was an immediate understanding of the novel in a Western way, which makes it immediately easier to write and be published. If you have a different vocabulary and a different way of structuring your narrative, it's much harder, which is why I wonder, why aren't there more books coming out of, you know, so many parts of the world are just silent on the bookshelves. You don't hear anything. We're all waiting for the books from Iraq, and where are they coming from? You know, there's so many parts of Africa, you can't think of a single novelist in the publishing world. It's missing. And you wonder why it's missing, and you think there's such a huge gulf. The vocabulary is not even beginning to carry. We have different vocabularies for love, affection, loyalty, use different words. You can't use that word if you've grown up in a Western way, or the way you present a character and their psychology is completely different. And so there's a particular kind of Indian book, of Indian writer, and it's not that I could write anything different. I've grown up in that, but... the bigger gap is what is really worrying, is really frightening to me.
Why don't we take one more question right here in front?
Hi, I wanted to know what you thought of the Columbia program and who you enjoyed working with there.
Columbia was the last, I mean, I've been through many writing programs. I really owe my... beginning to write even to a writing program, one at Bennington in Vermont, Bennington College in Vermont, and then I went to Hollins in Virginia for 1 year, and then to Columbia. I have mixed feelings about Columbia. I mean, in a way, I wrote, and I'm grateful to just to have had that legitimacy of space and time. But in a way, I think a writing program works in the end by not working. I mean, it should work until it really doesn't work. And, you know, that it makes you conscious self-conscious about reading, about how you're writing. And that can be good to begin with. But in the end, I mean, I found that I had to really lose that self-consciousness in order to write this book. And to be able to get to the more darker, the weirder places, it's hard to do when you're writing for a group and everyone's watching, and begin to write for group approval. And I think your work becomes like advertising in a way. You sort of simplify and do the difficult bits because you know that so-and-so in the class doesn't like this, so-and-so in the class will object to that, so-and-so. A taste doesn't, and you just sort of make it so everybody, once it passes through and everybody likes it, I mean, is it worthwhile as a work of art? I mean, I think partly that's why we're seeing so many short stories, so many books coming out that are just, you know, they're perfect. They're perfect books, and they are perfect works of art, and they seem to have gone through this process, and they're left so that you have nothing really to say about them because they're all fine. Everything's fine. You look at it, it's fine, it's all right. People say, what do you think? You say, it's perfect. And yet it's incredibly depressing feeling because you have no human response. Something that's raw, rough, difficult, eccentric. I mean, this is why we keep those people as friends too. I mean, when you're talking of it in terms of people, we treasure those ones who are, a lot of us do anyway, the ones who are, you know, more human or odder human beings, not the ones who just say the generic words to you. And that sort of human response is so important. Whether work of art is perfect or not seems the secondary question seems less important than if you manage to get to a place that's, you know, that's difficult, uncomfortable, odd, weirdly funny, and to get to that, I found that eventually that writing workshop was, I mean, it was hard for me to even begin that attempt. And then, let alone if you're a slow 7-year novelist, and you're supposed to present something every 3 weeks. As it is, you're not doing well in a program. So.
Well, we're glad you got out of the program. Please join me in thanking Karen Desai.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.